From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Roger Angel would never point this out himself, but he has written for The New Yorker longer than anyone still alive. His first story for the magazine appeared in 1944.
These are colleagues of mine in the fiction department, all eyeing me as we go by. This is all fiction.
Roger Angel is 85 now. He walked us around the sleek New Yorker offices, all blonde wood and curved lines. His first stories in the magazine were fiction, and then what he's best known for, many stories about baseball. Stories that hum with both the wonder of a new fan and the wisdom of a longtime observer of the game.
This is our disappearing view.
Roger Angel is a fiction editor at the magazine, still goes to the office every day on the 20th floor of the Condé Nast building in Times Square.
That red building there is the old New Yorker building, the one right there I'm pointing to.
That view will be gone soon. A huge new high-rise is going up next door.
It's a very New York thing to happen. It happens to everybody. You think, now I've got a wonderful view here. And in a couple of years, somebody comes and builds right next to you, and it's gone. It happened to me once. I was working for Holiday Magazine. I was at 5th Avenue and 56th Street, and they built a building right next to it. And this came right next to my window, and it was like the cask of a Modelado. They got laying in bricks, and finally he looks through the last brick and says, well, goodbye, and puts it in place.
How fitting that a Roger Angel anecdote sounds like a New Yorker cartoon. Angel has just published a memoir, essays about his childhood in New York, his time as a machine gun instructor in World War II, and mostly about his fractured family. His mother, Catherine White, was a fiction editor who worked at The New Yorker from its earliest days. She divorced Roger's father, Ernest Angel, to marry writer E.B. White, known as Andy, whom she met at the magazine. So when Roger Angel joined The New Yorker himself, he says, I went to work at the family store. He has a picture in his mind of his mother at work, glasses down on her nose, cigarette in hand, manuscript in front of her.
And then the weird thing that happened was that in the years went by, I came to work at The New Yorker, and then after a while, I moved up in status. We moved around, and I actually moved into her old office, which is the weirdest thing in the world. It was a nice office on the corner with five windows and a big closet. And the second or third day, I opened the door in the closet, and there's a big mirror there and a box of her ancient Coty face powder left over as if in a museum. And I was seeing a shrink at the time, and he said, the greatest act of sublimation in my experience.
It's interesting to think of you in that office.
If you're looking for an influence, I mean, the real influence, I guess, although I certainly didn't think about it at the time, was that Andy White was the first writer I ever saw writing. This is in the 30s or late 30s. He'd be writing the weekly comment page, the little editorial page of the New Yorker. He'd do this on Mondays, and he'd close his study door in Maine, and he'd be in there all morning long, and the typewriter would go and then stop, and there'd be long silences, and he would mail it off in the afternoon, and he would say it isn't good enough and be very gloomy and very serious. And then when it came out, he'd say, well, it's all right. But writing is hard, and his writing, as much as anybody's, looked effortless and simple and direct. But doing that isn't easy. And the reason for that, I think, is that writing is thinking, basically. There's not much you can do when you get to a passage and say, oh, I know how to do this part. Even that doesn't come as easily as that.
Mm-hmm. You write a lot about your family in this book, about your mother and the divorce, a bitter divorce with your father, and then her remarriage to E.B. White. And a lot of it is very personal, very revealing. Did you think about how much you were going to reveal when you decided you would take on a memoir?
That's a good question. These stories did occur to me, and in each case I had to wait until the right tone suggested itself. The matter of tone is very important. None of this writing about my family is get-even writing. I'm not anxious to settle any scores. I've worked all this stuff out myself, as we all have to. But I think as we get older, all of us have scraps of memory that stay, that are very strong. They come up again and again, a little scene, a little moment. And you think, why am I thinking this? Why is this there? It's often not something important, but we do, for some reason, get these little bits, these stories we tell ourselves over and over again. And often, when you tell them, they're in a slightly different form. And it is a form of fiction, really. I say these true stories at the beginning of the introduction. These are true stories, but they're stories.
There are times in the book where I get the sense that you're getting frustrated, that memory is stopping at an anecdote. that the anecdote is a shriveled version of what you wish you could remember.
Well, you have to remind the reader that anecdotes are anecdotes. I mean, I love to send signals to the reader. I always think about the reader when I'm writing, and anecdotes are not a proper way to sum people up because they're too sharp. And you say, if it's a strong anecdote, you say, oh yeah, well that's the way this person was. And books that are written entirely in anecdotes are you should be suspicious of. And of course, I've told a lot of these little stories down the years over and over again, which makes me suspect them.
We've been talking about memory and what you hang on to and what you don't. I was wondering if you could read the beginning of the chapter you wrote about your stepfather, E.B. White, the chapter you call
Okay.
Andy.
Lately, I've been missing my stepfather, Andy White, who keeps excusing himself while he steps out of the room to get something from his study or heads out the back kitchen door on his way to the barn again. He'll be right back. I can hear the sound of that gray door, and the steps there lead down into the fragrant connecting woodshed as the lift latch clicks shut. E.B. White died in 1985, 20 years ago and more, and by missing, I don't mean yearning for him, so much as not being able to keep hold of him for a bit of conversation or even a tone of voice. In my mind, this is at his place in North Brooklyn, Maine, and he's almost still around. I see his plaid button-down shirt and tweed jacket and his good evening moccasins. One hand is holding a cigarette tentatively. He'll smoke it halfway down and then stub it out. And he turns in his chair to put his martini back on the Swedish side table to his right. It must be about dinner time. What were we talking about just now? We were close for almost 60 years, and you'd think that a little back and forth, something more than a joke or part of an anecdote, would survive. But no. What's impossible to write down soon after is a conversation that comes easily.
I'm struck by what you say in the beginning there of that feeling of not being able to hold on to someone in memory.
Yeah, well, that's all there, but the conversation is gone. It's, you know, the one downside to all this for me is that since I've written these pieces, these people are farther away than they used to be because these stories don't come back anymore. Because if you write them, it's as if you put them away. And every writer knows this. I've talked to writers who've written about themselves, and this happens to everybody. It's as if we're saying that's the way it really was. And, of course, that's not true. It's just the version that got into print.
That's interesting. You mean the act of capturing it in print?
It makes it, puts it farther away. Yeah. The story is not quite the same.
The danger.
But it's not tragedy. I mean, that's just the way things are. And I'm glad I've done the book, and I'm glad the stuff is in there. And I'm getting very old. If I forget everything, I can still read. Now I can read the book.
Roger Angel. His book is titled Let Me Finish. And you can read an excerpt at our website, npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.